This week we go underground. Yes, under the earth. You know, there's geological records of great catastrophes that have befallen the earth thousands and thousands of years ago. A lot of the time there was huge populations that appear to have dug underground cities, and we find them in Turkey. We see them in different parts of Europe, in Asia, and in Central America. And that's what our program is all about today. How did Earthman adapt to hostile surface conditions when the planet's surface was either too hot, too poisonous, or just uninhabitable? Where did people go? Now, we know about it, Turkey. Turkey has a number of underground cities that have been discovered. But in Central America and South America, there are tunnels, there are shelters, there are special locations that have been created for people to live. This week, we discover underworld habitats, massive tunnels under cities, under pyramid systems, and these are not really well known. We'll also hear from Melissa Tittle. She'll be providing us with a perspective of underground cities in Turkey, what it means, what the technology was, because a lot of these places appear to have boring equipment that cut out in the solid rock tunnels, huge caverns or giant rooms that held thousands and thousands of people. Our media critic, Adam Young, will highlight the week with some great selections on streaming media and give us an idea of where we can look for not only underground information and underground tunnels, but also other interesting bits to include in our viewing pleasure. All this and another great program today on Earth Ancients. For Saturday, April 28th, 2018, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, how you doing? Welcome to another week of Earth Ancients. I'm Cliff Dunning. Hope you're doing well. You know, I wanted to mention, I think I mentioned last week that this expo week, and I'm actually in a hotel recording this, and so we're about ready to launch the opening of New Living Expo in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's held just south of San Francisco at the San Mateo Conference Center. And the Bay Area is made up of different cities. You go to San Francisco and then you drive south on the 101 freeway to lovely San Mateo. And there's a monstrous conference center there where we'll be located for the next 3 days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, 27th, 28th, and 29th. And I'm really looking forward to it. I always am interested in meeting a lot of people that I speak to on the phone. Meeting them up close and personally is always fun. And Colin Andrews is going to be in town. And I just got a copy of his new book, Cygnus Key. And it's filled with really interesting photos and graphics. Really looks like a good read, and I'm looking forward to talking a little bit to him about this new book. He is focusing more on Göbekli Tepe and the early dynastic and pre-dynastic Egyptians in this book. And he doesn't get into this star cluster and this megastructure to the level that I thought he was, but it's still a tremendous amount of work that he's compiled in this book. You know, when you write a book, and for those of you who have not written a book, it is a tremendous amount of work, dedication, and patience. And I'm trying to put one together myself right now. And I have great weeks where I have super patience, and then I have other weeks where I'm like, yeah, I got other things to do. And you can't do that when you're writing. You have to stay focused because you kind of build on each chapter and you build on your writing. And for me, and I write articles, you know, I write, you know, 1,000, 2,000 words. But to write a book, you know, 70, 80, 100,000 words, it takes a lot of time and energy. And I think Andrew mentioned that he had been working on this book for 6 years. And when we had him on the show about a year ago, he had mentioned that the book was really a bit of a challenge simply because of what he has uncovered related to the ancient pre-dynastic Egyptians, but also the cosmological details that he had found in researching this book. So the Cygnus Key, we're going to have him on the program in May to talk about this book. I will do some short interviews with him at New Living Expo and at the big monster show June 1st through 4th, which is Contact in the Desert. And that's the big show on at least the West Coast for ancient civilizations and ancient aliens. We heard Victoria here on the program mention that she's going to try to have one in New York and one, I think she said, in London. So we'll find out more about those shows as they come up. So anyhow, I'm here. I am doing my thing, preparing. I got to pick up some people at the airport. And then it's all about balancing, making sure people are handled. As a program director, most of the work is the preliminary work. And I've been doing this for probably about 25 years, probably more than that. But it's contacting these individuals, getting them flown out here, handling their hotel, and making sure that their presentations go off without a hitch. And that's working with AV teams, working with volunteers, and on-site coordinators to ensure that the audience gets the best of each of these individuals. So anyhow, this is the big week. What else? Oh, hey, by the way, Colin Andrews, publisher, is providing me with a case of these new books, the Cygnus Key, and I will be raffling them off next week, and I will give you that information. I think it was 12 or 20 books in a case, and I will let you know all about that. I want to also mention that I am going to do some some audio interviews at the show at New Living Expo, and so stay tuned for those. A lot of that is going to be placed on the Patreon page because I want to kind of get down and really focus on some of the personalities involved in these books that we are focused on here, get personal opinions, and some of it's not really appropriate for general consumption, but I want to place these on the Patreon page. And if you're not a Patreon subscriber, this is what really makes Patreon a real force to reckon with. And that is that I can place unedited audios and videos on the Patreon page. And by the way, to see these, you go to Patreon, patreon.com/Earth Ancients. And for as little as $5 a month, you can see and read and experience all these additional bits of content regarding Earth Ancients. Now, the most important thing is when you subscribe, it supports the work we do here at Earth Ancients. So check it out, patreon.com/Earth Ancients. So again, this is Expo Week. I'm very excited. Tons of great people here. I mentioned we will cover a few people. We'll get some on-site interviews, and we will play them in the coming weeks. And I like to get people's impression of the shows and what their how their interactions are going with the audience members, because people want to ask questions and they want their opinions. And this is also a great way for a new author or an existing author to get a sense of how people are going to react to the contents in their book. And, you know, when the people ask questions, a lot of times, you know, it makes the author think about what he's written about, but also perhaps what he may have been thinking about, but did not add to the book. So that's why I say whenever an author or a well-known research investigator comes to your area, comes to your city, try to go and see them, because a lot of times even though the book was written and it's done, it's been on the shelves for a year or more, they have lots of other research that they may have not been able to add to the book. And it's in the form of slides and in addendum or the beginnings of a second version or third or so on, perhaps even a trilogy of books on the same subject. So when you see someone come to your area, try to get there. Try to get there and see them. So anyhow, I will be paying close attention to how people are reacting to the various speakers that we have here at New Living Expo here in San Francisco Bay Area. So it's going to be fun. It's going to be great. I drink way too much coffee during these things because I have to stay up. And I don't know, some people think staying in hotels is great. I don't mind once in a while, but I used to travel a lot and travel to Europe and stuff. And flying and staying in foreign hotels, it's not really it can be really stressful because you're eating foreign food. Sometimes it's not what you can eat, and so you have to kind of really make tough decisions. Yeah, I'm enjoying it. I'm not complaining. Luckily, in San Francisco, I can get pretty much anything I want, and there's lots of coffee here. So, you know, good to have some coffee. All right, so I'm going to read a few emails for this week, and we'll start with. This is from Jack Chonaschi. I think that's Chonaschi. And John titles his email, Koba and Other Stuff. Oh, this is fairly recent. Okay. Hi, Cliff. Thanks for everything you do. I listen each week and must say I'm really impressed with your comprehensive survey of current news and new discoveries. How do you find it all? Just web searches? I think it's great to hear about all the new developments that occur, especially since there's no way this stuff shows up in mainstream news sources. You often mention the size of sites like Koba, stating the site is 10 miles square. Do you mean 10 miles square, the space roughly 10 miles in an area, or do you mean an area about 10 miles wide by 10 miles long, in which case the area would be 100 square miles or 10 times the size of the first interpretation. That's certainly a large area either way, but it would be nice to know what you're talking about. Okay, just for a heads up, when I was mentioning Koba, the Citadel, well, it's actually an acropolis where there's a lot of big pyramids, a couple of ball courts, and some smaller buildings is 10 miles square. Now, the entire site of Koba is 34 miles square, 34 by 34. So I don't know if that makes sense. That's what they tell me. The thing that's weird about Koba is, and this is generally the situation for a lot of these ruins in Mexico, just a fraction of Koba, maybe 3-4%, has been excavated. And when you go to these ruins, you see these mountains of rock and you think, well, that's a weird kind of a mountain. It's all rock and dirt and weeds and trees are growing out of them. Well, those piles of rock are actually buildings and pyramids. And when they get a chance to excavate, they carefully deconstruct the mountain and lay out all the stones. And then they follow the foundation and some of the outer walls and begin to rebuild what the pyramid looked like. Like years ago, I would go down there in the mid-1990s, like 1995, and you would see some terrible reconstructions. You'd say, oh, what the hell were they doing here? They didn't do a very good job. But now they use various systems to survey the site and also scan the site, and they can really get pretty close to the way the buildings were originally constructed. So anyhow, that's a little side note. So 34 square miles is what I understand it is. So that's Koba. Okay, John goes on. I also enjoy the theme music Atlantis by Olive Musique and would like a copy. Okay, I'll send you a copy. a suggestion for you. Perhaps someone you've interviewed, though I'm not sure you've come across this yet, is her name is Sylvie Ivanova. And she has lots of videos on YouTube under the name of New Earth. Lots of interesting speculation on intentional redating, misinterpretation, and manipulation of dates and events in world history. Also, she has a charming delivery, adorable Russian accent, and angelic voice. A real trip just to listen to her over and about her content. In addition to her traditional research, she apparently engages in remote viewing to corroborate her work. Okay, after I send this off, I'm going to get a prepaid card so I can buy a Patreon subscription. Cool. Thank you, John. Thank you, Cliff. You're doing an awesome job. Okay, John from Milwaukee. Appreciate it. Oh, and he also says he's 50 miles due east of Rock Lake. That's where he covered the story about the Rock Lake giant. So, okay, John, thank you for that. And I appreciate the Patreon subscription. That makes the wheels go round and round. Okay, this next one's from Rob Gadd. And Rob says, have been following your travels and videos. Cliff, thank you for your work in unraveling hidden ancient history. I've been on a quest this lifetime to do the same thing for myself. And with the help of many, I am able to put most of the planet's Earth history into perspective. Currently trying to put a master volume together to explain the cosmos and the reason we are here on this planet at all, and explain recent ancient religions and the mistakes of the current ones, the true nature of the afterlife, and the beings we call aliens. For now, please understand that we are the aliens, and this is the fifth time in the history of the planet that man has inhabited Earth. Have had many technological societies in past times between calamities and extinctions. Earth is best described as a seed planet, and that all life throughout the cosmos is related to one or another animal, vegetable, and every living being. We all share the same RNA, and while there are higher levels of dimensions and beings, we have the same shared DNA and life energy spirit that is nearly endless and eternal. If you wish to know more, I can give specifics and historical explanations as to why history of advanced civilizations are hard to uncover with common archaeology, and that there are many discoveries that governments and academia are hiding or covering up to keep the sheeple in the dark. Sheep and people. Sheeple. In the dark. Best regards, Rob Gadd, Albuquerque, New Mexico. Great. Hey, thanks for writing. And if you want to send me a letter, send it to cliff@earthancients.com and I will read it. So we're all about tunnels this week and underground cities. And I was curious to get the opinion of Melissa Tittle, who you know from Gaia. But Melissa's been creating and producing all kinds of interesting shows, from Ancient Aliens to programs on the History Channel. Of course, now she's got her hands full with producing programming for Gaia. And I sent her a video of this underground city in Turkey, Derinkuru, and it's not only is it fascinating, and I think it has great evidence for artificial construction. In fact, I even think it has some areas that were probably bored with some kind of machinery. But it's fascinating for another reason, and that is, I don't know what the hell the damn age is. They kind of skip around the age. But it's great because Graham Hancock's in there and Hugh Newman and Andrew Collins. What did you think, Melissa? What did you think of that?
I found it pretty fascinating. It kind of reminds me of the hypogeum in Malta.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Especially the way that – but the hypogeum, I believe, is they've actually done tests where it's all about sound, right? You know,
yeah,
I don't think that the tunnels in the video are that caliber, but they look similar. They look very similar.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you got the sense of machinery in this Turkey location, but it sure looks like it, because they are walking down this deep tunnel, and it's even, the width is perfect for hundreds and hundreds of feet. And it's like somebody cut that thing. Derinkuru, underground city of Derinkuru.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and then it opens up into different levels. And then, there's a presentation by Andrew Collins before they go in. And what were you telling me before we started is that Graham Hancock mentions that it's the lower sections are newer?
The lower section, he mentions in the video that the lower section is actually a newer installment to the levels. There's 8 levels, and the top levels, he said, are the older installment. And he thinks the bottom 4 mm-hmm. are part of a newer installment based on the fact that it looks more like a cathedral. So that would fall into maybe a different time period. But I just found that odd, because you think that if we're listening to Andrew Collins' research and that, you know, people decided to carve out this underground city because there's a catastrophe going on above, you think that they would be deep underground, not just below the surface. Maybe below the surface would have been carved out and used in different time periods to evade war or a hiding spot or, you know, any of that kind of stuff.
I wonder if they dug deeper because the surface was so bad that they needed to go down to, much deeper into the planet so they could. Because if you look at these canals or these tunnels, there's these huge round blocks that they pass to block off the entranceway, and they have a bunch of those, and so it would probably block off any kind of heat, but I don't know about poisonous gas. Who knows what the conditions of the earth were when these things were built? Do you believe that mm-hmm. they were built for a catastrophe, or do you believe that they were built more for evading war zones and warlords or people that are after them?
Well, I think in most ancient cities that people use what was already available. So I think it started out as creating a city below to evade some kind of catastrophe or mm-hmm. Armageddon, or, you know, there's all of the 10,000 BC possible flood, fire, there's asteroids, you know, Venus hit the earth, you know, all the theories.
Possibly,
you know, the aliens blew up a planet and then it, you know, hit some of the earth, you know, all that stuff. I mean, but whatever happened at that time period, I think that that's originally why it was built, that maybe they had a warning of some sort. And so they mm-hmm. built this kind of underground city. Also, you'll notice that the structure, I mean, it's quite large underneath, has what looks like wells, you know, like a hole at the surface that looks like you put a bucket in.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, it looks like a well, but it's actually a breathing tube.
Oh, really?
And you see that on the video, that they strategically put these in areas because, you know, the deeper you go, you need to breathe, right?
You have fresh air.
So on the surface, if there was an invader, you could see that it just looks like a well, that that's all it is. But it's actually a breathing tube. So I don't know. That's interesting. So I think that the humans, at some point, it was built for something a lot older, a lot greater. And then, of course, during some of the early development of history of humans, you know, they probably used it to evade.
I didn't even think about the possibility of it being originally carved, whatever, 10,000 years ago, and then as needed, it was subsequently re-bored for additional or other calamities or hiding from invaders kind of thing. That's a great idea. It's a great thought.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. humans are pretty smart, you know, sometimes.
Yeah. I would like to know what was going on that would force people underground. And so that's a very big query that I have is what were the conditions of the earth that would force people to go underground? And who knows how long they were down there? It's like, God. So.
Well, I mean, how, and then the question is, how do they survive down there? I mean, they couldn't be down there for like, you know, 50 years. Where was their food?
Right.
I mean, maybe they had sources of water. I think they did have, they showed some sources of water in the tunnels, but I mean, like they had to leave at some point, come back. So I think,
I mean, they must have stockpiled like tons of food. They must have known. Maybe not. I mean, who knows? We don't have any record of it, but well, Jesus, who in the hell would build something like that? Is just
okay. Okay. Wait, hold on. There's those TV shows where people are building those huge bunkers. Right? What's it called? I can't remember.
Oh, bunkers?
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, like the doomsday.
Oh, you mean the atomic bomb?
I mean, you think that's crazy? Yeah. But you're not so far off. Those people are like serious about their shelters.
Yeah.
So think about if the whole world had a huge warning. I mean.
Yeah.
People are creative. So I think that whole community got together and said, okay, we're building the largest doomsday prepper bunker with 8 levels possible.
Yeah. Very cool. Anyhow, I'm going to post it. I'll post this video for people to look at. It's on the Facebook page. And I think you should do a program on that. I haven't seen enough really good programs on these underground cities. I'm sure they're out there. I would think that National Geographic would have put one together, but I don't know. I haven't seen them.
Well, I'm sure they're out there, but that's definitely a big topic at Gaia is there seems to be a lot of people that are asking about underground cities, underground beings, inner earth beings, any of that. It seems to be a fascination. I see that as a pattern too. I wonder if sometimes we all pick up on the same thing, if it's like a inkling that we're drawn to for some reason. Maybe there's some information we're supposed to gather from.
God knows David Wilcock will come up with something and go, oh yeah, I'm writing a book about it. He's into all kinds of stuff like that. He's got I was the first one to write about this. Okay, David. Anyhow.
Well, you know, everybody's got to claim something, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure the person who made the first hole in the city was like, I made the first tunnel.
Yeah, exactly. And they're all over the place. So, all right. Hey, very cool. And thanks for your insight. We'll check in with you next week.
All right. Sounds good. See you later.
I was reviewing this week's list from Adam Young, our media critic, and Adam each week comes up with just a great list of topics that are, I mean, from around the world, actually. And this week he features Graham Hancock in a presentation at Contact in the Desert that I was at last year. And I didn't see this. I missed this presentation because I was too busy hanging out with some other people. But not only does he have Graham, he has a Kaliasa Temple, which for you that are listening, this is just a real phenomenon in India. And so we want to talk about that. So, hey, Adam, what's going on, man?
Hey, Cliff. Thanks for the intro.
Yeah. Tell us about Graham. Graham, this talk, I didn't even know it was being recorded, and you found this on YouTube. This is a talk he gave last year. I guess it's kind of a look at a lot of ancient cultures from a world perspective, right?
Yeah, it's kind of another summary of his beliefs. And every time he talks, he kind of reveals something else. And he just goes off and talks to a small group of people for a little over an hour about how he got into the subject of ancient culture, which is always interesting because he was like a financial journalist, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and then he talks about the Ark of the Covenant, which was his first foray into this subject matter, is when he went to Ethiopia trying to do a study on the Ark. And he discusses that quite a bit here.
Great. Yeah, that's a great, it's a good piece. It's a YouTube streaming media, and I have it here for everyone that I will post under the banner this week. So he talks about solid rock temples in Ethiopia that are now churches, and you give a nice little description of the piece. So that's very cool. Okay, let's get into this Kaliyasa temple in India. Now, this is, for those of you who don't know about this place, this is a temple that's carved out of solid rock. They give some typical dates for it, but hey, tell us a little bit about this, Adam. This is a really well done YouTube video.
I think this is one of the most underrated structures. I know the pyramids get most of the focus, but this is just mind blowing how any group of people could ever make something like this. It's the largest monolithic structure on Earth ever built by humans that we know of. So, which means it's a solid piece of rock connected to the earth that's carved into a huge building. Right. If you see the pictures of it on this video that I have recommended, it's intricately carved. And the insides, you have like the same flying buttresses and the other architectural features that you'd imagine, but with highly ornate detailing, trim work, carvings. So, you know, and how do you account for that? You have one shot to do this.
Yeah,
you can't mess up. You have no margin for error, you know?
Yeah, and one of the things that's fascinating about this is that they carve actual elephants. And here's an example. So you have a mountain of solid rock, and somehow you carve it down so that you expose temples, animals, people, wheels, carts. I mean, there's some everyday kind of looks and feels and things. This is relief or sculpture on a very exacting scale. I don't know how in the hell they did it, but it's one of these. It should be one of those 10 phenomenons from the ancient past that we have no explanation for.
Yeah, so you're talking about high relief. For those of you listening that aren't sure what we mean, like think about Braille. If you're reading a Braille book, the letters stand out. So when you're doing this with stone, you have to start with a bigger piece if you want to reveal a letter that's sticking up, right? This entire temple is covered in high relief, which is what you see in the oldest structures on Earth. So that's a very big clue that tells you this is higher technology, most likely, and very intricate, very old. This Indian temple, though, get this, it's dated based on some graffiti that's low relief, that's carved into the stone much later, obviously.
Yeah.
Just like everything in Egypt, right? The last guy to make his imprint on it is who dates it.
Which drives me nuts.
Yeah.
They do this in Egypt all the time. We know now that a lot of these Ramsey II sculptures are extremely old, and then the latest pharaoh and the dynasties come up and go, okay, I'm going to put my name on this. And so the Egyptologists go, okay, well, Pharaoh Billy Bob lived 2,500 years ago, so that must be the person who did it.
Yeah, and Billy Bob scratched the name off of his brother, like, you know. So you can't even tell who was before him because they've desecrated the original hieroglyph or symbol. This is the same as saying, let's date a structure or a monument based on the pottery shards we found.
Yeah.
Because pottery shards in Roman times were essentially like paper plates are today. You'd go on a picnic, you'd eat your food, and then you just throw the shards off the cliff or smash them onto a rock and leave. It was just disposable because it was so cheap to make.
Right.
So how could you date a place based on that? It doesn't make any sense.
So Kaliyasa Temple, what is this? What is the current date they give it for creation?
It's total nonsense, so I wouldn't even be able to recite it. It's probably, you know, their current date's like 1 or 2,000 years, but it's probably pre-cataclysm, pre-flood.
Okay. Yeah. Again, for those of you listening, have a look at this video. It's just a mind blower in terms of the sheer size and the scale of the carving. and the way they actually carve the animals. They're just beautiful. Okay, let's move on to Eagle Castles. This is in Turkey, and this is a place I haven't heard of before. So talk a little bit about it.
It's a little less known, a little less well known than the one in India or some of the other solid rock hewn monuments, if you will. They call it a castle because it kind of resembles a rounded shape, which might have been the interior of the structure. So we could be looking at the inner core of whatever remains from what was once a much larger structure or set of structure. There's a couple of different buildings, and it's similar to the Indian one, except it's in much worse shape and it's not as ornate inside, but it's still a monolithic structure connected to the ground. So they started with a big hill or a mountain and carved it away until you are left with this structure that's connected to the earth. I think the bigger question here is, why would anyone do that? Why don't you just take stones or bricks and build something from the ground up? Mm-hmm. It's much harder to do this. It's not even twice as hard. It's order of magnitude more difficult. They did it because it was necessary. They wanted it to be like that. They wanted the building to be touching the bedrock of the earth.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think that's a big question.
Now, one of the things that I read in your short description of this Eagle Castle in Turkey is that they think that it could be 25,000 years or older. That's a real mind blower for them to even consider dates like that.
Yeah, it's a funny little snippet in this short documentary that's only 3 minutes long. The narrator mentions that in the 40s, there was an archaeological, I guess, survey done of the site, and they suggested that based on the weathering, they didn't think it was 1 or 2,000 years old. They thought it was maybe 25,000 or more. And that was very quickly brushed under the carpet and forgotten about. Huh. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Amazing. Okay. Eagle Castle. These are a part of a YouTube that you can see on the Facebook page. When I post it, it'll automatically go to earthancients.com where you can see all the details there and view these streaming media. Adam, as always, excellent. And boy, you really made me think again about the ancient Turkey. And Turkey is just a hotbed of ancient history that we just don't know enough about.
There's so much there. It's incredible.
Right. Okay, great. Good work as always. And we will talk to you next week.
All right. Thanks again. Talk to you soon.
The boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
Each week I choose three topics, news that comes from around the world, some of it from you, the listener, describing ancient information, new discoveries regarding our ancient past. Scientists at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. have begun a new biogenome project. It's kind of like a modern Noah's Ark. And what these scientists want to do is collect and store the genetic codes of 1.5 million known species. These are animals, insects, all kinds of things. And this new library of life could be used to find out more about Earth's evolutionary past. It's how its species have developed and grown over tens of thousands of years. Currently, less than 0.2% of Earth species have been sequenced, and this international group of 24 different scientists want to collect and store the genetic code, as I mentioned, of 1.5 million plants, animals, fungi over the next decade. Now, this result, this amazing library will cost about $4.7 billion to create. It's one of the most ambitious projects ever undertaken in modern biology and history. So, yeah, it's kind of like a modern Noah's Ark. And you can read all about it on the Facebook page or go to earthancients.com. We have an excellent flyover, a drone flyover sent to us by Egyptologist Mohamed Imbriam. And Mohamed is my guest next week, and this is going to be a fabulous show. And just kind of a prelude to next week's program, he has sent a high-level drone flyover of the Giza Pyramid. But this is not simply a flyover. Basically, this is a programmable drone in this video, and he flies over not only the pyramids, but some of the smaller buildings that are very rarely imaged, and he got permission to use this drone, and this is a fabulous image. Now, I want to remind you that next week is not a show to be missed, simply because Mohamed is an Egyptologist who happened to be trained by none other than Zahi Hawass, Dr. Zahi Hawass, who is constantly in the news. And I think you're going to get an earful from Mohamed on just what he has discovered, not what is typically discussed in Egypt. So finally, scientists from the University of Nevada have made an astonishing discovery. Apparently, Neanderthals, or people similar to Neanderthals, were traveling from the shores of Europe to various parts throughout the Mediterranean, and they have found evidence leading to the Greek island of Crete as far back as 130,000 years ago. Now, this is a stunning revelation because up until this point, the earliest evidence was about 10,000 years, and now with this new discovery, tools and bones and even parts of wooden panels, parts of boats have been found on the island of Crete. And this is brand new discovery that pushes our understanding of ancient man to the very distant past. 130,000 years ago is just a stunning revelation. So anyhow, this is great news for us who are dealing with ancient past. You can read all of this and more on the Earth Ancients Facebook page, or just go to earthancients.com and you get all the news. Today's interview is brought to you by Journey to the Land of the Maya in Mexico. This is the sacred pyramid tour that I'll be giving November 17th through the 24th. That's the Thanksgiving holiday, but it's a great chance to get away from it all. Join me for a few days in Yucatan, Mexico, and we'll be viewing most of the top cities that are left to us in the Mayan world. That includes Chichen Itza, Uxmal, Ekbalam. We're even going to go to the Caribbean side of the peninsula and visit Coba. And I love Coba. Coba has some of the largest pyramids, standing pyramids that are still remaining to us. We'll climb these pyramids. We will bike around. It's just a huge place. I talk about Coba a lot. But we're even going to go to Campeche, and we're going to see Edzna, which is a fabulous ruin. We'll enjoy lunch each day at a number of really cool places. This is a very reasonably priced tour. Fly into Yucatan, then we'll be bused all over the place. We'll meet with our guide, Mimo Gonzalez. Mimo will take us to some of the ruins that are recently discovered. And this is just a great time. For more information, go to earthancients.com/tours. The entire itinerary is there. We're about a third full. I'm only going to take 25 people. This means that it'll have a personal touch. And this is a great opportunity to see Maya's ancient past. earthancients.com/tours. Come out and join me. It's going to be a blast. As you know, I have a great interest in Mexico and Central America. And I wanted to kind of touch on the underworlds of Mexico and Central America, those areas that are not really well documented. We only hear about the underworld when we learn from archaeologists in Central and Central America and Mexico, who are excavating under pyramids. There's a great deal we do know now about Teotihuacan. I have written about the Quetzalcoatl pyramid, which is also known as the Pyramid of the Serpent, and what the archaeologists discovered underneath the pyramid and how it may have been some kind of a machine. But I wanted to bring in our friend Marco Vigato to tell us more about his research. And Marco's been really focused on a number of locations throughout Central America and Mexico. And today we're going to talk about unknown areas of different parts of ancient Central America and Mexico that are not discussed, that have been known by the locals and the native people for centuries. And so Marco joins us again today to talk us a little bit about what he's discovered. Now, Marco's in Mexico City. He's right in the heart of Mexico. And so he has his finger on all the latest research. Marco, how you doing today?
Hello, Cliff. Good morning. Good morning.
Yeah. How are things in Mexico these days? How's the weather today?
Oh, it's pretty good. Beautiful summer weather, blue skies, so cannot complain.
Fantastic. I want to go through your understanding. You've done quite a bit of research and have written about the tunnel system at Teotihuacan. And before we get into the systems that are there, as well as some of the other places, why do you think the ancients actually wanted to dig underneath their buildings and their pyramid complexes?
Well, I think there are several reasons. Going from, let's say, the more utilitarian reasons to more symbolic ones. Of course, people have been digging underground for quarrying to get minerals and other types of construction materials for centuries. And this is not only a phenomenon limited to Mesoamerica. You find it all over the ancient world, where you find very large underground quarries and ancient mines. But this is perhaps the least interesting reason why you would want to investigate these tunnels. What I find much more interesting is the symbolic aspect of these galleries, which is something you find very strongly in Mesoamerica. As a matter of fact, at places like Teotihuacan, but also throughout the Maya world, people were building vast underground complexes of chambers and tunnels with a very clear symbolic function in mind. Mm-hmm. They were meant to represent the underworld. And that's the reason why you find those underground tunnels very often associated with pyramids and their ceremonial centers. In a certain way, you had the pyramid symbolizing the world mountain rising to the sky, and then you had the underworld beneath. You always have to keep in mind what was the cosmological conception of the ancient Mesoamerican people. They felt that the world was divided into three planes. So there was an earthly plane where people and animals dwelt. There was a celestial plane and also an underground or subterranean plane that was the kingdom of the gods of the underworld. It was a dark place. And that's the reason why in many cases, like at Tunina, for instance, in the Maya world, or at Teotihuacan as well, you find these sprawling underground complexes under pyramids. And then, of course, there might have been also tomb, like a burial function for these tunnels. In many cases, like at Teotihuacan, it's been speculated that some of these tunnels might lead to some yet undiscovered royal tombs.
Okay. Now, one of the things that I'm very curious about getting your impression on is that you have also discovered a very, very early people who were megalithic builders, mm-hmm. and you are chronicling this this early period that are mm-hmm. Significantly older than the Aztecs. Those people had perhaps another reason to build underground tunnels, because we know there's an underground tunnel system at the Pyramid of the Sun, mm-hmm. And also at Teotihuacan, and also the Pyramid of the Serpent. Those ancient people who were actually the original builders, we don't know how old they are. They may be 10,000 years or older. They wouldn't have the same feel of building for the underworld theme, would they? And maybe their purpose may have been to activate the machine, I wrote about the Pyramid of the Serpent at Teotihuacan and how they found mercury, mm-hmm. They found right. other combustible agents as well as water that were mixed somehow in these underground tunnels and maybe combusted to create some kind of energy. So what is your feeling about these megalithic builders and how it relates to underground tunnel systems?
Well, I think we enter here into a very speculative subject. Of course, there are many points of contact also with alchemy and, let's say, some of the more esoteric sciences as well. I think there is definitely a possibility that some sort of alchemy was practiced by ancient civilizations, which involved mixing celestial influences with the earth current, what was known as the terrestrial serpent. So at the end of the day, the combination of celestial energies and underground currents that occurred at certain sacred sites. I think that's a very fascinating possibility, a very fascinating explanation of what might have been going on at these places. What is certain is that this has been going on for a very long period of time. People have been digging these tunnels and vast underground labyrinths for literally thousands of years. Actually, probably the oldest portions of this tunnel network may date back to the original megalithic builders that, as I've also written extensively through my articles, I believe originally settled in this part of the world, probably as much as 10,000 years ago, making it one of the oldest civilizations on Earth.
Okay. Let's talk about Teotihuacan, simply because there's so much underground there. I discovered a couple of years ago that, and it's not talked about a great deal, that under the biggest pyramid in that area, perhaps one of the biggest pyramids in the Americas, is the Pyramid of the Sun. Can you talk a little bit about the tunnel system there? And it has similar features to the Pyramid of the Serpent, but obviously it's significantly mm-hmm. bigger. And the tunnel has little break-off rooms, and it goes all the way to the middle, and then it's all over the place. What did you find there?
Well, there are actually two separate tunnel systems under the Pyramid of the Sun. The first one was discovered in the 1950s by French-American archaeologist René Millon, who found evidence for a huge blocked shaft penetrating down to an unknown depth under the Pyramid of the Sun. He could not carry out excavations of this shaft because of the overall stability of the structure, but his theory was that this blocked tunnel could lead to an immense tomb under the pyramid. Mm-hmm. And then there was also the discovery in the 1970s, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was actually 1971, of what is perhaps the most famous tunnel under the Pyramid of the Sun. It's about 100 meters long, and it goes from the eastern side of the Pyramid of the Sun to a chamber, which is pretty much located under the apex of the pyramid, underground, which is in the shape of a clover leaf. So it has four little side chambers. This chamber and this second tunnel system does not seem to communicate with the earlier one that was discovered by Millon in the 1950s. And it actually appears to be of a much cruder construction. Actually, archaeologists now speculate that the original builders of Teotihuacan might have actually either utilized an already existing cave or expanded it artificially for some ritual functions. Unfortunately, all these tunnels under the Pyramid of the Sun have been looted in antiquity, so very few artifacts have been found under the Pyramid of the Sun itself.
Interesting. Now, can you talk a little bit about some of these new discoveries they've made? I think it was about it maybe almost a year ago that archaeologists began using ground-penetrating radar to discover not only the underground network at the Pyramid of the Serpent, but there's other underground tunneling systems that are throughout Teotihuacan, aren't there? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. So one of the most breakthrough discoveries at Teotihuacan happened in 2003 when a new tunnel was revealed under the Pyramid of Feathered Serpents inside the Citadel compound. This tunnel has now become very famous after large quantities of liquid mercury and some very mysterious pyrite spherules were found inside the tunnel. Since 2003, over 50,000 artifacts have been recovered from the tunnel under the Pyramid of Feathered Serpents, and the excavations there are still ongoing. Unfortunately, now seems that the tunnel ends in a small empty chamber, so there do not seem to be any other chambers or a connection with a larger tunnel network there. But still, the discovery is extremely fascinating, particularly because of the many artifacts that were recovered. And more recently, I think it was just 1 year ago, it was announced that another tunnel was detected by means of ground-penetrating radar right under the Pyramid of the Moon, which seems to follow a very similar path to the other tunnel discovered both under the Pyramid of the Sun and under the Pyramid of Feathered Serpent. Yeah. Actually, this is not that surprising considering the geology of Teotihuacan. It's a fact that the entire city sits on top of an immense network of caverns and lava tubes that were created by volcanic eruptions thousands of years ago. So the entire subsoil of Teotihuacan is honeycomb with tunnels and caves.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. So there is actually lava tubes underneath portions of Teotihuacan, or directly or around the perimeter?
Right. Many of these lava tubes run directly under the pyramids. Some of these are immense. There is a restaurant actually right at the perimeter of the pyramids that entirely housed inside a huge cavern that might be some 100 feet high and 100 feet wide. It's a really huge cavern. Hmm. And there are many more of these underground spaces under the pyramids. A project for mapping some of these tunnels have been ongoing for several years now under the direction of the Mexican National Institute of Anthropology. But there are literally miles and miles of tunnels. There are even reports that some of these tunnels would run for up to 50 miles under Teotihuacan and some nearby places. And they're certainly interconnected. The point is that the number of blockages and just the general conditions of these tunnels, which are in most cases crumbling or very dangerous to explore, have made all attempts at reaching the lower levels of the system extremely difficult and complicated.
Interesting. I want your opinion. In fact, Marco, I have not asked you this, but what is your opinion of the original intent in building Teotihuacan? It's a monstrosity. It's very, very sophisticated in its layout and design. And I was wondering what you believe the function of that facility was. I call it a facility because I believe it had almost like it was like a utility place where energy was created. But I'm just curious about what your opinion is.
Well, what is truly fascinating about Teotihuacan is that it was a planned city, meaning that all that you see there today was planned from the beginning. It's something rather unique in Mesoamerican, I'd say also in world archaeology. You really have the perception that it was just put there by somebody and built according to a plan that we cannot yet quite understand. Mm-hmm. It's also very much in line with the ancient legends of the Toltecs and the Aztecs, speaking of some foreign missionaries or some foreign demigods who came and built Teotihuacan in a previous world age and then left without leaving many indications as to the reasons why they would have undertaken such a colossal construction project. There are definitely some interesting hints that come from the location of Teotihuacan from its astronomical orientation. As a matter of fact, the entire city is not precisely oriented along a north-south axis. It's oriented some 19 degrees east of north for reasons that are not quite yet been explained. But that might be related with the particular geodetic position of Teotihuacan. If you take the latitude of Teotihuacan, it sits at around 19.5 degrees of north latitude, meaning that if you were to inscribe a tetrahedron within the Earth with one of the vertexes at the South Pole, one of the other vertexes of the base would fall exactly in the location of Teotihuacan, latitude 19.5 degrees north. So there might be something related to geometry of the Earth and perhaps, as was mentioning before, to the exploitation of some sort of terrestrial or telluric currents that might have inspired the design and construction of Teotihuacan.
When you say a telluric field, would you say that it's underneath the pyramids? Each one has a ley line or a telluric energy field underneath the main pyramid, or are they scattered throughout that entire area?
I think it's probably more scattered throughout the area. I think the layout of the pyramids, just talking about the three main pyramids, seems to be more symbolic to me. There's certainly some mathematical relationships involved. Have been very extensive studies, particularly by Hugh Harleston, on the geometric arrangement of the pyramids and the structures. There might even be a connection, which I find very fascinating, with the Giza pyramids. As a matter of fact, it can be proven that the Pyramid of the Sun at Teotihuacan is almost exactly the same base as the Great Pyramid of Giza, but only half the height, meaning that if the Great Pyramid of Giza embeds a relationship to pi, the same relationship also occurs at Teotihuacan in the ratio of 4 pi, which I think may be, again, part of this kind of great game that was played worldwide with a network of sacred sites occurring at significant locations on the Earth grid.
Sounds to me like you believe that the original intent of, again, I call it a facility at Teotihuacan, which is, I believe, a big machine, that you believe somewhat of the same intent was built into this place. It was capturing energy, perhaps harvesting energy, intensifying it, and then directing that energy in some capacity to either local community or for some other purpose. If you were to say, if I were to pin you down and say, Marco, the original intent was to harvest energy, and you say the same thing. What was the energy used for? Is it similar to what we do today in that we have electrical vehicles and we power our conveniences with it, or how would have Teotihuacan been used?
Yeah, I don't think this was necessarily a technological or a technologically advanced civilization. What he believed is that they might have been able in some way to harness those terrestrial energies for a variety of purposes, like for agriculture, for instance, to foster the growth of plants, for health reasons, and even for something perhaps more spiritual in terms of spiritual advancement or even generating some sort of altered states of consciousness. I think that's much more in line with what we know of ancient civilizations, in particular of megalithic sites around the world, when there was certainly a component there involved with bringing fertility to the ground and also some sort of general well-being to the people who lived in the area.
Interesting. Fascinating, actually. Let's move on. You have a list of underground features that are throughout Central America, and you talk about one that's in Mexico City called Tomb of the Aztec King. Why don't you talk a little bit about that? What's that about?
Yeah, it's actually a small site, which for very surprisingly, it's located actually in the very heart of Mexico City, but it's known to only very few people. It's actually located in Chapultepec Park, which is the largest urban park inside Mexico City, right under the castle of Chapultepec. It's a huge carved rock covered with hieroglyphics, are believed to be representation of the last Aztec kings. There is also a colossal sculpture of a snake, which is carved out of the living rock at this point. And so this whole, I would call it a monolithic temple, really, is entirely carved out of the andesite rock that forms the hill of Chapultepec. There is also a tunnel entrance nearby, which is associated to a number of Aztec legends, particularly to the disappearance of the Toltec king Huemac, who was said to have entered this cave called Sincalco under the hill of Chapultepec, and there having entered the underworld alive. This tunnel entrance still exists very close to these monolithic temple with the hieroglyphic inscriptions, although it has been now sealed off by the Mexican government, I believe, over the course of the 1990s for fear that people would enter the cave and get lost. There are rumors that the cave itself might be connected to a much larger tunnel system that extends under much of Mexico City.
Interesting. Wow. I can't get enough of this underground Mexico. You have to write a book, Marco.
I will.
It seems like we get bits and pieces from the National Geographic magazine, who will report on substantial digs, but you're right in the heart of Mexico there at Mexico City, and you must be getting daily reports on discoveries and unearthings. Let's move on to some other subterranean areas, I want to hear what you have discovered at Xochicalco, which is an area that I'm interested in.
Well, Xochicalco is actually a pretty famous archaeological site. It's also a UNESCO World Heritage Site located less than 100 kilometers south of Mexico City. It's very famous for the Pyramid of the Feathered Serpent at Xochicalco that has some very interesting depictions. I've also written an article on that in which I speculate that this might be related with a traditional sunken land to the west from which the gods, in particular the god Quetzalcoatl, was believed to have originated. What is perhaps less known about Xochicalco is that under the hill on which the Acropolis and the Pyramid of the Serpents stand, there is a whole network of underground tunnels and passageways, only a small portion of which has been explored. Some parts of the tunnel network are actually accessible to tourists, particularly the so-called Cave of the Sun. It's a very interesting place. You enter through a set of chambers and tunnels that take you to a small circular chamber with a hole on the top. On certain days of the year, a ray of sun penetrates through the hole in the ceiling and creates a very peculiar effect. Actually, the ray of sun becomes so concentrated that if you put your hand under the light, you can almost see your bones reflected on the ground. So it's almost kind of ancient X-ray machine, which is still functioning to this day, and I find it truly fascinating. But of course, this is only the portion of the tunnels which is accessible to tourists and can be visited. But there are literally miles of tunnels under the hill of Xochicalco, and as I was saying, only a very small portion of it has been explored. It's certain that the extent of the tunnel that could be accessed and explored was much larger just a few decades or a century ago, when there were reports of much more extensive tunnels. Of course, cave-ins and the fact that some of the tunnel entrances themselves have now been sealed prevent people from exploring additional portions of this tunnel network. But it was also a tradition at Xochicalco that one of those tunnels would lead to Chapultepec, which I just mentioned as the location of another tunnel entrance in Mexico City, which is located over 100 kilometers away. Of course, you always have to take these reports with a grain of skepticism, but it's a reality that these tunnels exist under Xochicalco and that their extent is probably enormous. Also, what is interesting about the tunnels under Xochicalco is that they're entirely artificial. So unlike the tunnels of Teotihuacan, which are part natural and part artificial, those tunnels under Xochicalco are entirely artificial.
Yeah, Xochicalco is interesting because it looks like it's been continually occupied for thousands and thousands of years. And this is something that a lot of people don't understand.
Yeah.
And this is that when there is a devastation that wipes clean the people who are living in an area and who have built the original ruin or buildings, and then a local people or native people that are in the area will come and repopulate a city or a place and make it their own with their own sculptures and their own designs. But if you look closely, as you have found, there's a lot of basic megalithic structures that are the foundation that are from the original people. Do you find that quite a bit where you go?
Right. I mean, even at Xochicalco, of course, you have the Pyramid of Feathered Serpents, which is a megalithic construction in itself. And I've also written about the possibility that it might predate many of the other structures on the site. Mm-hmm. At Xochicalco, you also find evidence of what I would call Cyclopean masonry and Cyclopean walls, so which have been buried under some of the later structures. So it's very well possible that the original appearance of the site was much different than what you see today and much more similar to a sort of megalithic citadel with a small pyramid, also megalithic, on top, which is the Pyramid of Feathered Serpents itself. Mm-hmm. Of course, throughout the centuries, all of these was expanded by later civilizations.
You know, a question for you is the evidence of underground tunnel systems in cities in places like Turkey may indicate that in ancient times people went underground because the surface of the planet was not habitable. And I'm wondering, is there evidence of cities or significant underground dwellings in any parts of Central America or Mexico that connect with these tunnels?
Not that I am aware of. I think that the purpose of the Mesoamerican tunnels was quite different. I don't think they would be ideal shelters, or that their function was really that of sheltering a large number of people for an extended period of time. I think my hypothesis is that they were rather used for storing perhaps some kind of artifacts, and there is even a possibility, particularly with the tunnels in the Maya region, that they were even used as some sort of underground libraries or repositories of knowledge to store artifacts, tablets, manuscripts, to protect and preserve them for destruction.
Interesting. Okay. Let's talk about a cave that has some interesting features. Calcatzingo is a, you call it a mysterious Olmec base relief.
Yep.
And it also has a tunnel entrance. What have we found about this?
Well, I find Calcatzingo one of the most interesting megalithic sites in Mexico. It's basically a huge isolated mountain that stands in a plain. It's literally a colossal rock, which is covered in Olmec bas reliefs. Now, the content of many of these bas reliefs is particularly interesting because they seem to depict a sort of sacred cavern that we might speculate was located somewhere in the vicinity of Calcatzingo, if not under the hill, under the mountain itself. There is one famous bas relief which is called El Rey, meaning the king of the mountain, really, which shows an Olmec ruler holding a bundle of objects that could be scrolls or some sort of manuscripts, sitting on a throne inside a cave from which some sort of clouds come out. There are also other very curious depictions at Calcatzingo of bearded men that look a lot like the companions of Quetzalcoatl, if not Quetzalcoatl himself, was supposed to be a god who came from a foreign land that was described as white and bearded. And that these figures are always portrayed with a number of very strange objects that resemble scrolls. There is another one which is portrayed next to a stela or some kind of upright pillar covered in unknown symbols. So all of these, I find it very suggestive of the possibility some sort of cave might exist at Calcatzingo that was used as a repository of knowledge or as a sort of hall of records, to use an expression which is very common among esotericists.
That's impressive. Let's talk about the Maya labyrinths that are found in Chiapas and in the Yucatan. I have seen them up close and personal at Uxkentuk, which is in the Yucatan Peninsula. I've actually been there a number of times. And as they were excavating, they discovered this partially underground labyrinth there. But I didn't know there were similar labyrinths in Chiapas. What was the purpose of creating a labyrinth? And before we get into the purpose, please explain to our audience what a labyrinth is.
Well, these are structures of course, they're called labyrinths because these are underground spaces. They have a number of tunnels and passageways that lead to other chambers, but without any specific order. So it really feels like they were meant to confuse, perhaps as part of some ritual or in order to fulfill sort of a sacred function. The most famous labyrinths that are found in Yucatan and Chiapas, as you mentioned, are the one at Uxquintoca, whose ancient name was Satun Sata, which literally means a place where one gets lost. But then you also have labyrinths at Tonina and at Yaxchilan. The one at Tonina is particularly interesting. It's actually called a palace of the underworld, most publications on the site, because it is believed that it functioned as some sort of cult center or an initiation chamber for rituals related with the gods of the underworld. It's actually found right under the pyramid of Tonina, which is considered now to be one of the most massive in Mexico, if not the largest in Mexico, and was meant to represent the underworld, like the underground layers of the terrestrial dimension, with the pyramid on top to symbolize the cosmic or celestial mountain. And very similar to the labyrinth of Uxquintoca, it also consists of a number of interconnected passageways. They were clearly meant to confuse. Of course, you have to imagine that at the time there was no light inside those labyrinths. So The initiator, whoever entered the space, would find himself in complete darkness, wandering through these labyrinthine corridors and passageways.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The most complex of these labyrinths, though, and the most unusual, in my opinion, is the one which is located at Yaxchilan. Yaxchilan is a fascinating Maya site, a very remote one, located on the banks of the Usumacinta River, very next to the border with Guatemala. What is particular about this labyrinth at Yaxchilan is not only its extent, as a matter of fact, is actually the largest of all the labyrinths that are found in the Maya world, but also the fact that it extends on at least three different levels, while the other labyrinths only extend on one level, at most on two levels. This labyrinth of Yaxchilan also appears to have been partially constructed out of masonry and partially dug out of the living bedrock. So there are many more tunnels that are visible, particularly in the lower levels of the labyrinth of Yaxchilan, that have been intentionally blocked in antiquity, because you can see traces of masonry that are clearly ancient. And so it's very well possible that further levels of this labyrinth might exist. I actually had a very interesting experience there when I visited Yaxchilan in January, because there are literally portions of the labyrinth when you walk through the underground passageways and the ground under your feet sounds hollow, as if there were more tunnels or more chambers underneath, perhaps in the yet unexplored levels of the labyrinth that have been sealed off.
No, it's funny you're mentioning Yaxchilan for its unusual characteristics. If we look to one of the ancient seers, not ancient, fairly recent, but he's been dead now for many years, Edgar Cayce points to the Lost Hall of Records, the records of Atlantis, and possibly a very early sophisticated civilization, the records being placed there somewhere. What do you say about that? Is there any... Because we've had people on the show. We've had Dr. Greg Little and his wife, who have done significant research, and they believe it's there too, but they just haven't found it.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with the research of Dr. Little on the location of Cayce's Yucatan Hall of Records. As a matter of fact, his theory is that this Hall of Records might be located at Piedras Negras, which is another Maya site also located along the Usumacinta River. What is fascinating is that Piedras Negras is located less than 30 kilometers from Yaxchilán, so the two sites are very close by, but I believe there are many more hints to the possible existence of a hall of records or some other type of underground repository Yaxchilán than there are at Piedras Negras. Something that and very fascinating about Yaxchilán is the presence of a number of stalactites that were erected by the ancient Mayas in front of the most sacred buildings of the city. Some of these stalactites are huge. They measure over 3 meters in length. And they're a very puzzling feature because they're not found at any other Maya site. They also greatly struck and surprised some of the early explorers of Yaxchilán, particularly the archaeologist Theobald Mahler, who speculated after discovering many of these stalactites there that some immense cave might exist under Yaxchilán, capable of producing such enormous stalactites. He could not find any entrance to this cave or tunnel system, but it's very well possible that the labyrinth that I was just described, might be somehow connected with this cave system, perhaps through some of the blocked passages there.
Caves play a huge part in Mayan culture. Of course, what we see is the remains, what I believe are the remains of a great Maya civilization. And for me, Maya means multiple cultures coming together to create this huge and dominant civilization, kind of like United States, where you have multiple multi-ethnic, multicultural groups coming together. And I see the same thing with the Maya. But talk a little bit about some of the cave systems. Like you mentioned the cave that's at Copan and what they represent. What's unique about the cave systems and being underground for the Maya?
Well, of course, caves have been sacred for thousands of years, and not only in the Maya world. There is still evidence of some caves being used today by the local Maya communities for the rituals. Some of the most famous caves in the Maya world are, of course, located in Yucatan, just because of the geology of this region. There is the famous Loltun Cave in Yucatan, just a short distance from the world-famous archaeological site of Uxmal, which contains evidence of human occupation dating back to at least 7,000 years ago, including some very interesting rock art and cave paintings there. But there are caves that were considered sacred throughout all the Maya world. One which I think particularly captured my imagination is the so-called Tibulca Cave at Copan. This is, I would say, an almost mythical cave in the sense that it was reported by early explorers of Copan but never found again. There's actually a very interesting report of the ruins of Copan, which I believe is probably the earliest published in the 1700s by Fuentes, who was then the historian, the official historian of Guatemala, which describe an immense underground temple. He actually calls it an underground temple rather than a cave, dug out of the living rock and containing a number of pillared holes with windows also carved in the rock that allowed some light to penetrate the dark interior of this underground temple. And it's fascinating that this temple could not be found by any of the later explorers of Copan, so that now it's considered to be almost a myth. Of course, many of the other structures that were described by Fuentes as still standing intact at his time are now piles of rubble. So it's very well possible that if this cave or underground temple really existed, its entrance may now be hidden under some of the rubble, or even be under the level of the Copan River. So I would not necessarily dismiss these tales of the Tibulca cave as just fables. I think there might be some reality to them, and there are certainly very large caverns in the vicinity of Copan as well.
Mm. We're getting down to our last few minutes here. I have an interesting question. You live in Mexico City. Would you say that the people of Mexico are a little embarrassed by how the Spanish treated not only the Aztec but the other people who lived there? As an example, it seems like we're continually hearing about complete pyramid complexes being found underneath the city of Mexico City, underneath the streets, underneath the buildings. It's like the Spanish just didn't want anybody to know anything about these people, and so they paved over their complexes.
Yeah, I think with the conquest, particularly the Spanish Catholic priests and missionaries tried to obliterate all remains of the previous civilizations and of pagan culture, particularly. So that's the reason why in many cases these structures were almost deliberately buried or destroyed. In some other cases, they were adapted to the new religion. You have a number of examples in Mexico, at Cholula, for instance, right outside of Puebla, and also in Yucatan, at Izamal, in which the Spanish conquerors built their churches and convents on top of the ancient ruins. So there is actually a Spanish colonial cathedral built right on top of the Great Pyramid of Cholula, and also at Izamal, the convent of San Francisco was built right on top of the largest pyramid there. So in a certain way, they wanted to eradicate what they considered as idolatrous or pagan beliefs. But at the same time, they recognize the holiness of some of these places. So rather than just destroying them, they tried to convert them to the new faith, to the Catholic religion.
Hmm. What is your impression of these underground cities? You believe that there was an important aspect to being under the surface, not only ceremonially, but also connecting with various gods and higher levels of consciousness is what it seems like. But what is your takeaway from all this?
Yeah, I think definitely the underworld played a very important role in the imagination of pre-Columbian cultures. There were a number of gods and divinities that were very clearly related with the underworld. It was considered to be the abode of the gods, just as there were gods in the sky, there were gods in the underworld. They were equally powerful over the fate and the destiny.
Hey, Marco, I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, there you go. Okay, yep. I just lost you for 3 minutes, or a couple of minutes. Why don't you start again, and I'll just edit that section out.
So what I was mentioning is that, of course, the underworld played a very important role in the imagination of pre-Columbian cultures. It was considered to be the abode of the underworld gods, of the gods of death in particular, and certainly had very important funerary associations, and also associations with the afterlife. That's something that we find all over and all across Mesoamerica in caves and artificial tunnels. And that, I think, speaks a lot about the symbolic or ceremonial function of these underground spaces. In a certain way, the ancients saw these tunnels as these caverns, as a way of communicating not only with their ancestors, but also with the gods of the underworld. There are many legends about cultural heroes of the Maya world penetrating into this underworld to converse with the divinities of the afterlife, with the spirits of the ancestors. And I think there's also a very interesting dimension here related to altered states of consciousness and the pursuit of some sort of, I would call it almost extracorporeal or spiritual experiences, perhaps under the influence of drugs and other hallucinogenics inside these caverns.
Now, you just made a really good point that I didn't think about, and that is levels of different consciousness when you go underground, that you don't have daylight necessarily, you don't have the same air, you have different environmental qualities that could create levels of consciousness that we're not aware of. And of course, if you have some special medicine plants added to that, that might together create an environment for connecting with consciousnesses on different levels of reality. That's a good point.
Yeah, I think particularly in shamanistic beliefs, and that's something which is still very common, can still be found among the local Maya population in some regions of Mexico, like Chiapas and Yucatan as well. There is still a widespread belief that under the influence of some of these hallucinogenic plants or drugs, and in particular types of settings, like a dark or underground space, the shaman could communicate with the gods or with the spirits of the deceased. So I think this is a very important symbolic dimension that might have played a role in the importance that was attributed to these underground caverns, and also might explain why artificial caverns like tunnels and chambers were built under some of the pyramids, some sort of depictions or representations of the underworld.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. When I look at the labyrinths at Oshkentok in Yucatan, all I can think of is claustrophobia, because I've looked under that building where this large labyrinth is, and of course the guides, their local guides, are saying, well, it was designed to connect with the gods, it was ceremonial, but it's quite extensive, and it does bring up claustrophobia, because it's pitch black. And of course, if it's a labyrinth, you're running into walls that don't open, you've got to go backtrack and go around again. So I don't, for me, getting inside one of those things is like, I want to get the hell out of there as soon as I can. So
yeah, and I'm sure you visited it with a flashlight, so you can only imagine what the effect might have been on the ancient peoples visiting those spaces in complete darkness, perhaps under the influence of hallucinogenics with incense or other like ritualistic implements made to enhance their experience.
Right. Fantastic. All right. Well, that's Ancient Underworlds of Central America and Mexico. Marco is a regular contributor to Ancient Origins online magazine. You can read his articles there. He's written a number of articles about just this topic, underground labyrinths and cave systems. And he wrote extensively about the Teotihuacan tunnels directly underneath the area, but also in neighboring cities. And he mentioned to us that some of these tunnels go on for miles and connect cities that are surrounding Teotihuacan. Marco, as always, fantastic work. Where can we hear more about your upcoming writings?
Well, I, as you mentioned, I'm a regular contributor of the Ancient Origins website. I also have my own blog, unchartedruins.blogspot.com, where you can find updates on some of my latest expeditions in Mexico and Central America, but also in other parts of the world.
Fantastic. Well, we'll look forward to catching up with you again. You're a regular Mexico Central America contact. So when we hear some news from that area, we always go to you. So, hey, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thank you very much, Cleef.
Okay, that's it for this week. I want to thank Marco Vigato for joining me and coming to us live from Mexico City. Special thanks to Curtis Hartog, Mark Foster, LeGrand Green, and the team that pulls together the show each week. It's great to have everyone with us. And next week, remember, we have an Egyptologist who is going to describe a very unorthodox history of Egypt and what he believes is evidence of machinery and a very advanced science in pre-dynastic Egypt. This is going to be a very fun show. So thanks again and have a great week, and we'll talk to you next time.